In this episode of Tim Talk, Dr. Gavin Ducker joins Tim to share his own struggles with depression and PTSD in hopes of erasing stigma about mental illness.
Thank you for joining us for this Tim Talk. I'm Tim Dentry, President and CEO of Northern Light Health. This is a very important talk. The purpose of these podcasts is to provide a platform for guests to express themselves, their views and experiences as it relates to diversity, equity, and inclusion. And it provides a platform for our audience to listen, learn, and hopefully become even better people. The topic today, living with mental illness, is very timely. Mental illness and behavioral health issues have skyrocketed in our country. I would venture to say that everyone listening to this podcast knows someone or experiences personally mental health and behavioral health matters. And they're deep and they're personal. And we need to talk about it. In today's episode, I'm joined by a respected colleague and friend who is sharing his own very personal struggles with depression to address the false perceptions and societal biases toward those with mental illness. Dr. Gavin Ducker is the co-president of the Northern Light Medical Group, senior vice president of Northern Light Health, and a family physician. Gavin, thank you for joining me here today.
Thank you for inviting me, Tim. It's a pleasure to be here.
I know one of the reasons you have chosen to be very public about your own struggles with depression, and I thank you so much for that personally, Gavin. It's because you want to show that depression can affect anyone. Can you share with us how it's affected you?
Yes, I can. That introduction is very moving, Tim. I'm just kind of getting my composure back for a moment because it's so much of what you said was true. Yeah, my personal story starts my third year of medical school in 1983. In the UK, you go to medical school straight from high school. So I was only 20 years old. I was single, kind of an immature young man, living in a very kind of high performance environment. I mean, I was studying full time, big expectations, lots of work to do. And in addition, I was playing for the university, the rugby team, which was another huge commitment in terms of time and effort. And, you know, I didn't have a good support network, and I'm not blaming anyone for that, but I was very kind of self-focused and doing lots of things, and I didn't really have time for that. And I didn't realize what was happening to me. I think the trigger was probably a family crisis, but that crisis didn't last very long, but I think that's what triggered it. It took 2 to 3 years for me to recover, and I was on my own. I recovered on my own. I didn't realize until I was further into my training and my career what had happened to me. But I do recall feeling very alone, and I'll give you an example of that. At one point, a relationship with a girlfriend ended, and she was playing for the university football team. I was playing that's soccer for you guys. And I was playing rugby, and you know, I turned up to the training session after it happened, and a couple of my teammates kind of came up with their hands on my shoulder and said, "Well, I'm sorry to hear about what's happened," and then kind of immediately lapsed into the training and what we're going to do on the Saturday, and that was it. And I knew for a fact that over in the other changing room, she'd been surrounded by teammates who were focused on her and her needs and giving her the support. And I kind of give that example because I think women are usually much more mature in these issues. They mature younger as well. It's kind of an example of what I had to deal with as I went through this. In terms of recovery, I think one of the things that helped me recover was the high, if you like, of graduating from medical school. I'd always wanted to be a physician. My graduation was in some doubt because of my performance dropped off as I got sicker, but I was able to kind of overcome that and pull it out at the end and begin my internship and then residency and move on with my life. And in terms of prevention, you know, I've always taken care of myself as playing rugby, training several times a week, eating well. I did stop smoking very soon after I graduated, took good care of myself that way. The second episode happened in 2003, which was about 2 years after I moved to the United States. You know, the move was a big upheaval and for my family, myself, my kids particularly. Can't say that there was any specific trigger, but kind of began to drift. Because the difference by then was that I'm more mature, more insight. And of course, I was married. And my wife was able to kind of sit me down and point out what was going on and what she was seeing. But even then, I found it very difficult to pick up a phone and call a colleague and tell him that I needed his help and then move things forward from there. He was great and saw me very quickly and started on treatment, and I responded very quickly, and I was kind of fully back to normal within 6 to 12 months. You know, in terms of prevention, supportive family and wife, and continue to exercise, eating well, taking good care of myself. The third episode of mental illness I suffered was PTSD, and I'll kind of tell you the story there as well. You know, one Saturday morning, I was on call for the hospital, so I was going in to round with my colleagues and the staff to see how everyone was going. I got up and exercised, as I typically do each morning. And about 15 minutes after I got off the bike, I developed some chest pain. I just had a huge coffee, so I thought, oh, you know, this is acid, you know. So I took a whole bunch of antacids, and it didn't really do anything. And I, you know, had my shower, and I was putting my tie on, and I looked at myself in the mirror, and I was white, and a little sweaty. And, you know, that's a little bit alarming. So I kind of thought to myself, well, if a patient called me now, what would I tell them? And I tell them, you need to go to the emergency department and get checked out. So I went upstairs, and in typical kind of male style, completely understated it to my wife. Oh, you know, I've got a bit of chest pain. It hasn't really responded. I better get myself checked out. Oh, yes, Gavin, of course. No, let's get in the car. Let's just went straight. Halfway to the hospital, the pain went out of control, severe. I mean, really so bad I could barely speak. I didn't tell her because she was driving and we were on the way to the hospital anyway. So she dropped me off at the front office, the front of the hospital, and said, you know, go in there, get checked out. I'll be with you in just a second. I'll go and park the car. So I walked to the front office. I was really feeling terrible. And the front, as it turned out, the receptionist didn't know who I was, which was a good thing because it was like being a secret shopper. And I just said to her, look, I feel terrible. I'm having chest pain. I need help now. And she did exactly the right thing. She said, sit down there, we'll be right out. Went and got help. Two staff nurses kind of erupted out of the ED. And of course, they knew me. Doctor, grabbed hold of me and took me off. And I'm taking my shirt off because I need an EKG. And everything happened exactly as it should have done. You know, I was given an aspirin. I had an EKG within 2 minutes. They're doing everything right. So I'm feeling pretty reassured. But I'm also thinking, this isn't a cardiac event. So this is a bit overkill. The EKG read towards me, and as it came off the machine, I suddenly realised, oh my God, this is a heart attack. I became a little bit emotional, as you'd expect, and of course a pandemonium breaks out, and nurses running everywhere, and drips going up. Because my wife walked into the room. You know, I'm feeling terrible, I can barely speak. She's put into the corner. And I remember her grabbing hold of one of the nurses and saying, well, what's going on? Oh, he's having a heart attack. I couldn't remember her face. It was, I was crestfallen. But anyway, so then I'm thinking, right, okay, so now they're going to put up the TPA. It's the clot buster. It's going to get rid of the clot. It's going to get rid of the pain, and I'll be much better, and I'll go to EMMC, and they'll sort me out, and I'm going to be fine. All the while this pain is they're not able to control this pain. So up goes the TPA, and, you know, 10 minutes later, the pain gets worse, at which point I realise, oh my goodness, I'm in real big trouble here. This could actually kill me. So I'm kind of trying to keep myself together. They're still unable to control the pain. The pain is really out. I can barely speak. They eventually gave me some Dilaudid, which may be a bit high. Didn't really help the pain, but it just made me feel a bit more relaxed, and so I calmed down a bit. They weren't able to fly me to EMMC because of the weather, so I was put in the back of an ambulance. And 10 minutes in to that journey, I thought, yes, I'm not going to make it. I'm oh my goodness, I'm just kind of focused on trying to take care of myself. And 10 minutes after that, this was the moment that really kind of put me over the edge. This pain is so bad that I think I'd rather be dead than put up with this any longer. which was really, I mean, it's very hard for me to talk about that moment, but it was a dreadful moment. But I kind of bounced back. I phoned my dad, I phoned Edwina, I phoned a whole bunch of people, and they just kind of kept me going. And we got to EMMC, and Dr. Alan Wiseman was waiting, literally waiting. He took one look at me, took me straight down to the cath lab. They did their work, their magic. I remember him saying, I'm inflating the stent now, and I went from the kind of worst pain I'd ever had in my life to like no pain at all in like 3 seconds. It was just such a tremendous relief. It really was amazing. And, you know, I was home 2 days later. I had normal heart function the next day. I was kind of really completed my rehab. But I had PTSD. I mean, I couldn't sleep. I'd wake up with nightmares. That moment of I'd rather be dead than be alive went on and on and on and on. And, you know, I sought help from psychologists, and they really have helped me and got me through it. And I was back to work 6 weeks later. I still have triggers. For instance, talking about it is a big trigger for me to revisit that moment. And the other one is looking into the back of an ambulance. It gives me palpitations and it makes me feel somewhat anxious. But, you know, I'm back to normal now. And, you know, but I live with this. I mean, it'll never go away. And, you know, that's kind of my story.
Thank you for sharing that, Gavin. And I just have a parenthetical comment for the listeners, actually. And that is, I just wonder, as we were all listening to that very personal story, and again, I thank you so much, how much of our listening capabilities, we got the part about the physical challenge, the heart attack and everything came along with that. And I asked the question of the parenthetical question, not for you, Gavin, but for our listeners, of, so how much do we get mental health side of things? And we're going to start to talk a little bit more about that right now with Dr. Ducker. But, you know, just my hope is that one day we all will be able to talk about mental health experiences and things of that nature as commonplace as we talk about the physical. So, end of parentheses. And so, Dr. Ducker, do you have any reservations about coming forward with all of this today?
Yes, I did. I mean, and I do. Indeed, I talked to you very briefly when you first started this podcast series that I had a story to share with you, and I didn't have the conviction to follow through with you about that because I was very conflicted. And let's be clear, from the story I just told you, I had to be, even though I was well supported and clearly understood what was happening, I still had to be persuaded to seek treatment for my second episode of depression. And the truth is that one in four of us will suffer a mental health crisis during our lifetime. And one in two of us will suffer some degree of mental illness. And as a family physician, about a quarter of all my interactions have some degree of mental illness as part of the problems that I'm helping my patients to deal with. So this is a common problem, and yet it's a hidden problem. And, you know, I've treated many patients over the years, and my patients have been the same. They felt reluctant and ashamed and wanted to hide it, and have struggled, often struggled, as I did, to accept the diagnosis and treatment. I was inspired, since I returned to work after my heart attack, by two patients. One had been treated for anxiety for over 10 years and really was no better off. And I persuaded her that there was a misdiagnosis and that we needed expert help and a change in treatment. And she responded almost immediately. But the barrier for her was that despite the fact she felt better, she was very conflicted about the diagnosis. I mean, she was much more comfortable with being diagnosed with anxiety because everyone knows what that is and lots of people have anxiety and that's okay. But to have what she had was, in some senses, a step she didn't want to take. And she was very conflicted because she was feeling so much better with treatment that for the diagnosis that she did have. But she kind of didn't want to take the treatment because of the stigma of the diagnosis. And she and I worked together for many months on that. You know, I reflected on the 10 years of misdiagnosis and misery she put up with, and that's what she and I kind of reflected on. And the other patient had a family who refused to accept the whole concept of mental illness. And so that was a very difficult conversations to have with her, but she literally had to change her views in order to accept help and get better, which she did do. But all the while, she had to hide the diagnosis and the treatment from her family. It was a big conflict for her. And I realized that if we are ashamed and judge ourselves, then we're perpetuating the biases, judgments and discriminations and allowing it to continue happening to others. And when I did that, I realized I was an active participant in the biases towards something that I myself had suffered from. And it feels hypocritical. And it's that which has driven me to kind of step forward and work with you today. You know, we worry that with a mental health diagnosis, that maybe there is something wrong with the person. And we scrutinize and judge their behavior. It's like we think the person is defective and they're not sick. We don't think like that about physical illness. You know, if a person has a skin disease or a heart disease, we don't judge that somehow they're defective as a person. We empathize and we try to help them. And the truth is that we all have behaviors and we don't always behave well all the time. But most of the time when we behave badly, we're not mentally ill.
Thank you so much. Very profound words. I hope my listeners really re-listen to, especially the segment you just shared, the whole podcast actually. What can our listeners do or say to help someone experiencing depression? How can we show support or at least not stereotype the individual?
That's a great question. And it does require some self-reflection. As I've said earlier, I myself struggled to accept what was wrong. So I was uncomfortable with support at first. And the same happened to those patients that I was telling you about. Once I accepted my diagnosis, support became much easier to accept. Given our societal biases and worries about mental illness, disclosing mental illness to another person is hard. Which is why it's been a challenge for me to come forward today. So if we can't be forthcoming with our mental illness, we're destined not to be well supported. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy that I'm on my own, I'm feeling terrible, I can't tell anyone, so you feel more terrible. And on the whole, the truth is that we all respond sympathetically to an individual who becomes sick for any reason. That's kind of human nature. That's what we do. And we're in the caring industry. That is what we do. And it's really beneficial if we do the same with someone with mental illness. But we have to know that they're suffering with it in order to be able to be supportive. And that's what I'm saying. There's this cycle. If I don't tell you what's wrong, how can you possibly support me through it? Yeah, many individuals with chronic illness will tell you that after the initial disclosure and response, it's often the case that the phone calls and offers of sympathy and help peter out. Because people struggle to know what to say or do, especially if someone doesn't have a curable illness. And if that's the case with physical illness, it's absolutely even worse for those with mental illness for the reasons I've just said. So we all need to do a better job of it as a society. We need to understand that this exists. It's very common. It's an illness like any other. People deserve support. They shouldn't be judged as a person. They may have behaviors that manifest from their illness, but it's an illness. So we can support and help and treat them and get them through it.
That's terrific, Gavin. And I think one of the, I don't know if it's lesson learned yet, in my life, but that I'm trying to be better at is to be able to talk with people and give them the sense that, without asking a blunt, direct question, give them the sense that it's okay to tell me what you might be struggling with. You know, let's talk about that. And it doesn't come naturally and easily to a lot of people. But you're absolutely right. Yes, I think it's a part of the onus is on those that are dealing with mental health issues to, you know, to not hide it, not put it in a box, to go about living your life and be feel free that you're not going to add to your burden by keeping that in. That's got to be just such a compounding effect, I can imagine. The same time, those individuals interact with need to, I think, have greater awareness that someone's behavior, attitude, maybe not as engaged or more engaged or what have you, that there might be something behind that. And it's okay to find that out. And it's okay to talk about it. Then you've got dialogue and a connection. Then it's not just sympathy or empathy or whatever. Then it's like, I get it. You know, I get it. I get you better now, Gavin, because you shared this. So thank you for that. So Gavin, I look at this as a message of hope. So thank you for this message of help and your courage in sharing your story. Before we leave, I know you want to leave our audience with a positive message about diagnosis, treatment, recovery, living with.
I had two episodes of a disease, depression, that I recovered from. I may have another episode, but I know what to do now. I had one episode that I slowly recovered from and never be entirely free of, which is my PTSD. You know, after recovering from my heart attack and PTSD, I felt a new lease of life. I really did. I was determined to make the most of my second lease of life. I wanted to do something that I really felt would impact people, make a difference. You know, I received the treatment I needed, and I've been able to continue my career and have a family life. So it's possible to recover and be treated and not have these issues interfere with one's life goals. One of the things that I will say to you is that mental illness, like physical illness, there are acute illnesses that where cure is possible. And I was lucky, I had two of those. Pneumonia, appendicitis, those kinds of things are analogous with physical illness. And then there are diseases that you live with. People live with heart disease, they live with liver disease, they live with cancer, they live with these other illnesses. And PTSD for me is the one that I live with. You know, it's possible to do that. And millions of individuals do that with physical and mental illness. It's possible to do it. It's possible to bounce back, and it's possible to continue to be successful. And, I really feel that I'm in a good place, and, I feel vulnerable having these discussions. I really do. A little fearful today of doing this, but I think it's the right thing to do. I think, that there is definitely a message of hope here.
Thank you. And, I think true strength is in expressing your vulnerability and not trying to cover it up with some false kind of strength.
Yes.
So true strength is being genuine, and we're all vulnerable.
Right.
Thank you so much, Gavin. And thank you, our podcast listeners, as well. So until next time, I'm Tim Dentry, encouraging you to listen and act to promote our culture of caring, diversity, and inclusion that starts with caring for one another. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Tim Talk. If you enjoyed this podcast, please join us next month for a new episode. And know that there are several ways you can tune into Tim Talk. You will find new episodes on our website at northernlighthealth.org/podcast. We are also on Google, Apple, and Podbean, which makes it easier for you to listen on the go on your favorite app.